place. Socialist alternative radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And we are here every other Sunday, alternative Sundays, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. And today's show is hosted by...
Diego?
Me, Diego. Wait, your mic's not up, Diego. That's my fault. Is it that number three?
Three.
Okay, there you go.
Hey.
Diego?
Finally. My own mic.
Diego, who got here in the rain and on a bike, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Extra Lenin Bolshevik points for that. And also myself, Jeff, and we're your co-hosts for today. And what's the date today? It's October 11th.
9th.
No, it must be different than that, right? Let me see. Maybe you're right.
I think today's the 9th, tomorrow's the 10th.
You're right. Sunday, October 9th, 2016. And welcome to the show. Again, this is WMFO Medford. That's WMFO in Medford. And also, sometimes we call ourselves Tufts Educational Radio. And while we hope today's show is educational, Socialist Alternative Radio also strives to organize you or help you organize to get involved in the revolutionary socialist struggle around the world, and including here in the U.S. And if you're new to the show, again, this is talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And we have been on the air for 10 years. We hope that we're, I wish we were less unique programming, but I think we're pretty unique around the radio, live radio dial. We are 100% pro revolutionary socialist, democratic socialist. We are 110% pro-union, all those things that, you know, perhaps your conservative uncle warned you about. We are. And we are here to get you interested in getting involved in the struggles that we talk about. We're not just here for alternative information, although that's a big part of this. And you can find other shows on the radio, usually on the far left where the college stations are, that have a FCC mandate to put on community programming, and then every once in a while a show slips in that's kind of left-wing or sounds left-wing or something. Those shows tend to disappoint me terribly. They tend to just really present a liberal perspective masquerading as a left-wing perspective. Here you have the true left, the tradition of socialism going back to the mid-1800s where very quickly people concluded that the system had to go. The capitalism, even in its infancy, was an exploited system.
I was watching the French Revolution History Channel.
Yeah, 1793. And,
Well, Rasputin, how you pronounce his name, the radical.
Where? In Russia?
No, France.
Well, there was a
French Revolution.
Bunch of them.
The first one.
Yeah.
1793.
And he also. Marat?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was very interesting that the people rising up, getting the Versailles, getting what was that infamous dungeon there, the Basque,
the Bastille,
Bastille, they destroyed it.
Yeah,
I was like, wow.
Yeah,
this is pre. What was it like?
It was
Marx wasn't even born yet, was he?
No, I don't think so. It was pre-capitalist. It was a bourgeois revolution, technically meaning a revolution to bring in actually the capitalist class more than the people, although it was mixed, kind of mixed. And the people fought to make it their own. And ultimately, it didn't become a people's revolution or a revolution of the working people, such as they existed then.
Up until 1848, right? They became...
Well, in Iraq, the revolutions in 1848 were very mixed. Throughout Europe, there were revolutions, and they were... mix of the working class starting to assert itself, but being brand new, and the bourgeois again, the ruling class capitalists managing to take over those revolutions for the most part, and it wasn't really until later in the 1800s, like for example, the best example would be the Paris Commune in 1871, where that was clearly a revolution by working people, and they overthrew. At least in this one area in Paris and a little bit around Paris, they overthrew the actual ruling class, the actual emerging capitalist class as it existed then, and they set up their own very extremely most democratic government known yet, and it only lasted 6 weeks. So a lot of historians that are pro-capitalist dismiss it, but for socialists, it's a landmark, a watershed moment. Yeah, because that early in capitalism, and you have. So you have class conscious workers with different radical ideas, some socialists, some other types, taking power, creating a new government that was nothing like the capitalist government, and being able to actually survive. But what happened was, as some people might know that listen to the show, if you're really into socialist history, or this is a great example to think about. And it's even a metaphor for the current elections. At one moment, the Paris Commune was born in the midst of a war. The war was Germany against France over territory. The minute that the workers took over in Paris in 1871, the Paris Commune, the two capitalist armies joined forces. And the Germans set up.
That kind of reminds me of El Salvador and Honduras.
There you go.
So let's work together, get these rebels out.
Yeah, and the Germans then stopped fighting, set up a rear guard for the French to go in and massacre their own people. It's funny you should mention that, because we're talking about this, because I was talking about this with my children. They saw a picture of, it's called Le Mur de Fédéral, also sometimes Federal known Mural. As the wall, the communards. Le Mur means the wall in French. So when I used to have enough money to travel to Europe when I was single, which I don't anymore, but I would go to Père Lachaise Cemetery, which is a famous cemetery because Jim Morrison and other famous people are buried there. But I would go there not so much to see Jim Morrison or Oscar Wilde or other people, although I did see them as well. But I would always go there whenever I went to France. I always go to Père Lachaise with a dozen or two roses and lay them at the wall of the communards, the Le Mur de Fédéral, because that's where I think it was about 800 men, women, and children were massacred by the French army. They were, because they had fought against the army coming back in to conquer Paris. There's a barricade fighting, incredible bravery, the entire population being involved in fighting against.
Like the massacre that happened in Boston over here, the Boston Massacre.
much more. And the Boston Massacre, again, a bourgeois revolution that people were fighting. If you read historians like Howard Zinn or Ray Raphael or others, they look at the
American... There were slaves American, involved in that the, one, I think.
Yeah, a freed slave, I think Crispus Attucks. But what happens is in these revolutions, or in the beginnings of capitalism, is that there is a mix of the new capitalist class trying to get power and establish its hegemony over the state apparatus and use the state to then repress. And enforce capitalism. And yet at the same time, there's common people, average people, that are fighting not for that. They're fighting because they don't like things that the British soldiers are doing. In this case, the American Revolution, they don't like things that are happening. And they think they can turn the revolution into something that will help them. And this is still happening today in a lot of countries where nationalism will be used by a section of the capitalist class to gain power. I mean, it's not the same thing exactly, but it's very similar. And they will just keep capitalism in place, and then the whole all the old repression and exploitation will reemerge and be used against the very people that fought. Like right now, I guess we just visited the White House.
Well, it's like Russia, right? In essence.
Yeah, Russia now. Yeah, yeah. But guess who just visited the White House? It was that woman from Myanmar, Aung San Suu Kyi, I think is her name, who was supposedly a opposition figure to a dictatorship or a military kind of police state that existed in Burma/Myanmar for a long time. And I always listen to those shows talking her up here in the United States. You know, she's a hero. She's in house arrest. The people love her, blah, blah, blah. And I always listen to those shows, and I kept waiting to hear, well, what does she stand for? What does she think of U.S. imperialism? What does she think of the poverty in her country? What does she think of the poverty in Asia in general, or the world in general? What does she think of socialism? Never a word about any of that stuff that I could find. I didn't look too hard, but I, you know, waited to hear it. And then they have an election finally. The military regime starts negotiating with U.S. imperialism and other governments and so on. And they have an election. She gets elected. She was popular. That part seems true, I guess, depending on how the election was rigged. Who knows? They're all rigged one way or the other by money. But let's say she is popular. And but she just turned up at the White House recently, you know? So if you're this, like, opposition hero of the people and you're coming to why are you coming to the White House? Why are you coming to the center of oppression around the world?
Is that gonna, the one that supported that, that regime that you're, beg
for,
you're against.
Coming to beg for some aid or something? Okay, I understand that to a certain extent, but I think it's a little more than that probably. It's probably like the next thing we'll know, there'll be another military base. You know, in the U.S., is, what is it, 150 military bases around the world? Let's set up another one in Myanmar. You know, to get at China. You know, they can see why. You can see the wheels slowly turning in the minds.
Yeah, we want one in Vietnam.
Yeah, the minds of U.S. imperialism are we could use another base to counteract China in Asia.
We can need another base in Turkey to counter Russia and all these.
Exactly, yeah. So getting back to...
And then Russia turned around and say, yeah, okay, we'll do the same thing in 62 in Cuba.
Well, there were headlines last week that, these alarmist headlines about Russia... telling its citizens to prepare for nuclear war and all this stuff, and I never saw whether they were true or not. I didn't see any more information about that, but I do hear on the national propaganda radio and on TV news and stuff, they're getting a lot of punches at Russia, a lot of shots at Russia right now, which as a revolutionary socialist, I don't care about Putin. I just question such one-sided propaganda, So I just wonder, okay. And it doesn't seem to, people don't seem to care, so it doesn't necessarily stay in the news cycle that long, the corporate news cycle, but it's definitely there. So anyway, if you've just turned in, you're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio with your hosts, Jeff and Diego, today, and we're going to be talking about the elections, of course, later, and talk about Trump resigning and what a scumbag Trump is,
Really? Did he resign?
No. Talk about it. Talk about him giving up. There's also a debate tonight between the two corporate candidates. And we'll have all sorts of information on that. But also, we're going to give you the revolutionary socialist angle on that. Because if you think because Trump is a pig and an idiot and a tool and a capitalist, you're right. He is all those things. Does that mean that Clinton is not some of those things?
He was boasting about the tax breaks and everything. Yeah, I just took advantage of that.
190 million tax breaks. And what I'm referring to, obviously, in case some students, whoever, are waking up from a late brunch and they haven't heard the news from Friday, the news was that Trump, a tape was released from a entertainment show called Hollywood Access. I don't know if it still exists or not, but it existed does, back in the 90s. And it was a tape of Trump saying really disgusting, sexist, abusive things towards women. And some of the transcripts of that tape have appeared in print with all the swear words intact. I heard a radio show, corporate radio show, National Propaganda Radio, on the way in today. The what they do on National Propaganda Radio now is journalists interview journalists, and they pretend that's interviews, right? So so National Propaganda Radio was interviewing the Washington Post, some Washington Post propagandist. Slash reporter, and they were saying, gee, the New York Times had the word, the F word on the front page for the first time ever. So this is all a big deal. And it should be a big deal. We wish Trump would resign. That would throw a wrench in the whole system and question the legitimacy of the system in a very good way from a revolutionary socialist standpoint. In other words, Clinton would get elected with no real mandate, because there's no, there'd be a question over any sort of claim to mandate, because there's no opposition really from the other side of the bourgeois there. Of course, Jill Stein won't be talked about, as she mostly isn't. But that is, my point is we would welcome a resignation from Trump. He's always been scum. But are we surprised? No. When Trump says Clinton talks his way on the golf course, he's absolutely right. And by the way, why does Trump say that? Because Trump and Clinton were friends. I was getting stuff on Facebook months ago.
First of all, showing my question is, how does Trump, she know that? You and Trump golfing with him?
Yes, that's so what I was about to say. I was getting stuff on Facebook months ago where Trump and Clinton are shown at parties, at dinners, chumming up. I mean, there was just that thing last week, I think, or maybe 2 weeks ago. I think I might have mentioned it on the last show, where Michelle Obama was yucking it up and hugging George Bush, junior.
On the opening of the African American
exactly.
Museum. Yes.
Yeah.
And then Bush came up and presented some, and I'm like, this is weird.
He made a speech against racism. It wasn't that bad. The part I heard, of course, it's completely insincere. He embraces.
Come up from his mouth and makes me go,
oh yeah,
really?
Oh no, he embraces the South. He went. Bush was this, Yankee patrician, old money type who consciously goes down to Texas, takes on a twang, completely false, embraces the South and all that racism and all the leftover, all the underground Jim Crow that exists there still, and to get elected, you know, less competition down there. You know, he's got more money than whoever. And the oil's down there, too, the American oil down in Texas and other places. Anyway, we're jumping a little far afield, which is fine, because we are going to get into the elections a lot today. Lesser Evilism, this is your channel. This is your station to fight Lesser Evilism for the next hour and a half or whatever. And we'll give you some good ways to do that. But right now, we want to go local. And by the way, if you're listening to the show for the first time, we do make a distinction between local, national, regional. Why are we doing that? International? Well, it turns out with the wonders of the internet, we do have international listeners. So if you want to listen from a place that this live signal doesn't go out to, which is most of the world, obviously our live signal hits Medford, parts of Medford, parts of Somerville, parts of Boston, parts of Cambridge. I've even heard it out on Route 2 a little bit going west. Is that west? North? I don't know where that's going. Out to the Concord, the Tony suburbs. But the point is that limits to the on-air, the live on-air signal mean that you might want to go online, obviously, to WMFO.org. Click on schedules. Click on Socialist Alternative Radio on Sundays, 11 a.m. every other Sunday. And you'll have at least one show archived if you're not listening to the live stream. And if you, of course, can listen to the live stream that way. So by that and by our Facebook page and so on, Socialist Alternative Radio on Facebook, there is an international listenership, and we're really proud of that and happy about that, and hope we can get information out about the U.S. that you might not hear otherwise. If you're stuck in, why am I saying stuck? If you're living in some place where the only information you can get is putting forward the dominant narrative here that everybody loves Hillary or whatever. The reality is much more complex. And even the corporate media here talks about these are the least trusted candidates since they've done polling about that sort of thing. And there's, of course, a lot of people there's a certain number of people on the left that I can see are just ducking down and trying to ignore the whole thing until it's over, you know, and then go back to real organizing. And while I sympathize with that, I reject it. And Socialist Alternative rejects that. Basically, the elections, of course, they're dominated by big money. Of course, they're not representative of the people, people's opinions or will. Of course, there's a two-party duopoly here in the United States, the two corporate parties, the Republican Party, the Democratic Party. There's all these horrible ways the elections are used to control people and to keep capitalism going. And we're well aware of that, and we're fighting that every day as Socialist Alternative. But also, we have to understand the way that mass consciousness forms is complicated sometimes, and I'd say all the time. And voting itself, right, is a good thing. Democracy itself, real democracy, is a good thing. People have fought and died for the right to vote. People have fought and died for the right to exercise democratic rights of all sorts. So we're obviously for that. It strengthens the workers' movement, and working people are ones that do the fighting for that sort of thing usually. But however perverse and wrecked that gets in the process, whatever meat grinder of lies and money it goes through and ends up into whatever, unrecognizable, creepy, pseudo-royal royalty thing going on with the American presidency, the office of the American presidency, there's a whole nother way of governing, you know, that doesn't have the trappings of the U.S., where most people are unelected to begin with that are in the U.S. government. There's a whole nother way of governing that's happened in the world and in the socialist movement. And there's ways to make elections work as an organizing, as a part of organizing. In other words, there's a way, I said that kind of awkwardly, socialists, real good socialists, I would say, revolutionary socialists, engage in electoral politics, not because they think that they're going to win. Sometimes you can win.
It makes platforms for ideas.
Exactly. Platform for ideas, a platform to organize from, a way to publicize things. Because of that, that idea, which is correct in the mass of people's minds, which is a very good idea, that voting is somehow good, democracy is somehow good, however ill-defined that might be, that there's something good about that, that they'll listen more during an election to, despite even a polarized one like this, you have this opportunity as a socialist to go out and talk to people about ideas and politics.
The referendums, the whole $15.
Yeah, exactly.
All these things come from organizing and the platforms.
And of course, you can do that in between elections, and you have to. And that's one of the big things we can get into. What's the weakness of the Green Party, for example? Like, we're supporting Jill Stein, but not the Green Party. Well, why? Well, the Green Party doesn't do campaigning work much or hardly at all between elections. Huge mistake. If we get a third party going here, an independent left workers' party, party for the 99%, however you want to phrase it, that's independent from corporate media, I'm sorry, independent from corporate money, and that is really truly a progressive left party, that will have to be a party that does not just re-energize itself every 4 years or every 2 years for elections. It's going to have to be a party that's rooted in working class neighborhoods.
It's like in Portugal, struggles. You see these, they don't stop after an election. They just keep on going and organizing. You know, regardless if you're a socialist or a communist or, you know, the new left, like you were saying.
Yeah, the left party in Portugal. Yeah. So it's very important that we argue it's very important that despite how crazed both liberals get, I'm talking about upper middle class liberals, especially in their defense of capitalism in their own way, and the conservatives around Trump and so on, how crazed they are, despite all that, and the domination of the corporate media and the corporate money in the election, which has now swung, you know, clearly behind Clinton for the most part. Despite all that, there are opportunities in the election period that will not exist after the election period, with some layers of people out there that you can talk to, that you can say, like you were just saying, Diego, here are some issues Jill Stein is running on. What do you think of those issues? This is a party, Jill Stein's party, the Green Party, or more importantly, Jill Stein's campaign, completely to the left of the Democrats. What do you think about that? Interesting, huh? There is actually a choice out there. But they're not, they don't want you to see it, but it's out there.
Yeah.
They don't want you to take it seriously. They don't want to let her debate, et cetera, but that choice is out there. You're interested in that? We're interested in that. You know,
that's they only not, talk that's not about our goal, her when she did something like vandalism, at a construction site. They were trying to, you know, do the pipeline through a Lakota. I think it was a Lakota.
Yep.
Area,
and that backfires because for a lot of people that was a good thing. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm like, right away. She's definitely voting for her now.
Yeah. Yeah, and they, you know, there's a lot of smear campaign against her, but mostly they just try to ignore her. And this has worked for years and years and years and years. The lesser evil thing has worked. You know, it's Trump, it's Bush, it's Reagan, it's Barry Goldwater in 64. It's you know, the boogeymen of capitalism thrown up against the supposedly more reasonable wings of capitalism who then get in power like Johnson and escalate the Vietnam War. Kennedy escalated the Vietnam War. You know, supporting Jim Crow. You know, in their past.
And Obama escalating this war.
Yeah, Obama deporting more immigrants than any other presidency. Obama doing the proxy wars in the Middle East, doing the drone wars. Obama not doing anything, really. I mean, there's an interesting layer of African-American activists, some older from the days of the Black Panthers and so on, but some very, very young, who are supporting Stein. And by the way, Cornel West, who was supporting Sanders, is now supporting Stein. And they basically were like, they have a critique of Obama that's basically like, you know, you had 8 years and what did you do? What did you do for us? You know, and Black Lives Matter, do they really matter to Clinton? You know, I mean, they're making these connections that are, of course, are very spot on, very important.
What's his name? Black Agenda Report.
Oh, they're completely for Stein. They're completely
against, what's his name?
Glenn Ford. Yeah. Yeah, Black Agenda Report, Glenn Ford, Bruce Dixon. I have an article here. I don't know if we'll have time to get to it by...
Carl Dix from...
I forgot her name. Kimberly... I don't know if I can find that really quick. Anyway, so... But, you know, before we get more into the elections, because, of course, the whole... another thing that happens during elections is that everything gets drawn into that whole prism. And there's things happening outside of the elections, of course, including Black Lives Matter protests in the past, you know, within the last couple months. There's a lot going on outside elections. 15 Now campaign continues in Minneapolis, led by Socialist Alternative in that city. There's the $15 an hour campaign in other cities.
Then the struggle in Charlotte
Charlotte absolutely. In fact, we talked about that in the last show, and we had a leaflet from Socialist Alternative. We were reading excerpts from, I think, Rise Up Against Law Enforcement Terror, United Massive Emergency Leading Now, Tulsa and Charlotte Explodes. And then talks about, you know, the history of Ferguson and Baltimore, the recent history and so on. But again, let's get into some local stuff before we go further with the elections. So starting, when did it start? Not that long ago, 4 days ago, maybe last Wednesday, I think. Yeah, last Wednesday. A big strike started in the area that the show emanates from here. And in Cambridge, Massachusetts, at Harvard University, about 700 dining service workers went on strike. They are in a union called Local 26, or Unite Here, Local 26. Here stands for Hotel and Restaurant Employees. And Local 26 represents these workers at Harvard, workers in hotels, and maybe some restaurants as well around Boston and other places, mostly a Boston-based Union Local Cambridge borders Boston, if you're not familiar with this area. So now this is a strike in a time when there aren't too many strikes. And it happened because Harvard, and I work at Harvard, so I can tell you a lot about this stuff sort of below the radar or whatever. The union that I'm in, the Clerical Workers Union, Harvard Union of Clerical and Technical Workers / AFSCME Local 3650, which I was a founding member of and helped with the organizing of that union. We have had this union since 1988, but unfortunately, very quickly after we won our union, got in, the union leadership decided to pursue a sort of partnership with management type strategy. There's different words for that within the labor movement: the team concept, business unionism, collaboration with management, you know, all that kind of stuff. And it's all horrible. Basically, it betrayed our efforts to get in a union that would fight for us and represent us. And the union has made gains. I mean, it's obviously better to be in a union than not be in a union, especially at first when we first got in and Harvard didn't know what to expect. They thought we were going to be militant and we were going to really go for it. And we gained a lot right at the
This is during Britain, right? It was going through its militancy too.
Yep, the late 80s. Yep. And so we got some things, especially in the first contract. That could have been a lot better, but it was probably the best contract. And then it's been going downhill ever since. There have been rounds of layoffs. There's been concessions. And our most recent concessions, which were totally unnecessary, were concessions given by the top leadership to management on health care. And, you know, increased costs of health care being shifted to the members, including me, which I can't afford and my family can't afford. And our union on paper is strong, right? We have almost 5,000 members. We should be able to go on strike and at least protest in a way that would really embarrass Harvard and so on. And yet the unionship did mobilize. Nobody organized. Nobody just entered into backroom negotiations and mediation and accepted concessions from Harvard. Those same concessions were then foisted upon, same or very similar concessions foisted upon the hotel workers in their negotiations, which happened after our contract. So Harvard, you can see how Harvard thinks, right? Harvard management is like, we got the biggest union on campus to accept these worthless, not worthless for them. They're going to make more profits, but we got them to accept these concessions. So now we're going to move to the weaker unions, right? Relatively speaking. Thing is, Local 26 has a tradition of off and on being more energetic and more militant than my union. My union's never had any kind of period of militancy and energy except for when it organized. And that's a crime. That's a shame. Anyone familiar with the labor movement in the United States knows that most unions, that the leaders aren't even elected. They tend to be the organizers appointed from the top. There are a certain number of important elections, but they can be rigged. They can be controlled. By the way, there's a Teamster election opening up that might be really contested between Hoffa, the incumbent who's been there for a long time, and an opposition figure in the union, and I forget his name. Anyway, back to the point of Harvard. So the hotel workers start into negotiations. Harvard's leaning heavily, of course, on the healthcare thing that my union, to their shame, accepted. And by the way, we did go to a vote, but in my union, basically, there's no organizing happening within the union. There's no education. So the idea of a strike seems like a very foreign, scary thing. And leadership uses that. They'll say, if you don't vote for this, you're going to have to go on strike. They don't explain what a strike is. There's no strike fund. They don't try to organize around a strike.
It's like the word
there
wasn't
even
radical.
A protest.
What do you mean? It's
radical. Scary. Scary. Yeah.
You know, in other countries, radical is good. You know what I mean? This is.
And with clerical and technical workers, especially the clerical side of that, you've got people working at Harvard in my union who have degrees that expected to be professors or something, and there wasn't enough room in the declining, squeezed up, you know, higher education market. They couldn't make it as adjunct faculty or something. They just couldn't find better jobs than working at Harvard, and which is not a very good job. And but it's a kind of, you know, for a lot of them, office work and so on. So they cling to it. And I'm not saying that in a derisive way. I've had all sorts of jobs, and the job at Harvard that I have, I try to hold on to it because I've been unemployed. I know how horrible that is. You know, I try to hold on to it, try to make the best of it. But if we had a union that really fought and educated the members to fight, we would be doing so much better. We'd be an example for the entire labor movement. When we first organized here, the rest of the labor movement supported us. A lot of unions supported us. And then when we got in and turned our back, the leadership turned their back on the rest of the labor movement, people were like, what happened? You know, and I had to try to explain it. Some people get it, some people don't. I had to, but the facts are what count the most, that there's no solidarity. Like, why should the dining hall workers at Harvard be organizing and negotiating separately from our union? We should all be together. Like at Yale, for example, they've got the clerical workers, the dining hall workers, and even the groundskeepers all negotiating together. And that worked really well for a while. Then even at Yale, it kind of broke down a little bit because the clerical workers union got conservative. So what I was starting to get into is clerical workers have a lot of illusions. They're working class, but some of them don't think they are, you know. And that
because they're at a higher pay, problems. They're white collar, or
their pay sometimes is less than blue collar. It's the, it's the illusion of white collar university work.
I'm pushing the pen or the pencil as opposed to lifting heavy boxes.
I'm on the computer all day instead of in the mailroom.
Or cooking, washing dishes. Yeah. Ooh, that's beyond me.
No, it's a lot of illusionary stuff. Like the average Harvard worker will be, someone out of college, in the clerical and technical union, someone out of college. They'll actually have a degree probably, or some part of a degree. They'll go to Harvard thinking that they'll take classes in the extension school there, which means really almost nothing, and they do that for in their 20s, and if they stick around, or if they don't get laid off or whatever, then they realize that, you know, they're not getting anywhere that way, and they get comfortable, you know, to a certain extent in the again, like you said, the white collar aspect of it, the being somehow part of academia and so on. I'm not saying everyone thinks that way, but I noticed that among a layer of my coworkers. But even those people could be educated for solidarity, to understand their working class, to help other unions, but they're not, you know. So like, I'm going to the picket lines when I can, and there's only about four or five of my coworkers that are doing that. The leadership of my union goes there and sort of just stands there. One or two leaders stand there and look at it and walk away, you know. They don't like the militancy of the hotel workers. So anyway, the point is that because of my union leadership caving so easily and so cravenly into Harvard's demands for workers to pick up more health care costs, Harvard wants to do that to the dining hall workers. Harvard is also, there's other issues, like the pay is just really low, should be higher, but there have been times where Harvard has gotten concessions from the union, from the hotel workers union, for the dining hall workers. So you know, everything's so expensive now. They're living in the Boston area, and a lot of them are making, you know, in terms of net pay, like in the 20,000 something, they can barely live. Their demand is for a $35,000 wage minimum for everybody. Harvard puts out propaganda saying, oh, the average wage is this, it's too high, it's a lie. Every strike I've ever been close to, management and the media will put out figures about average pay. Notice I'm using the word average, which means if you have one person making a lot of money, can skew the results. They put out figures about average pay. They're just completely ridiculous lies. They want workers to think that, oh, why are they going on strike? They're making good money compared to me. Why are they doing, you know, that whole American mindset? Instead of solidarity, it's a race to the bottom, you know? Hey, someone's doing worse than me. I feel good now. That's a bunch of crap, you know? So anyway, the other demand is that these dining hall workers, even with that low pay, they also get screwed over because in the summertime, there's a gap for most of them. For the vast majority of them, there's no work at Harvard for dining services because the students aren't there. And there's a little bit, but there's not much.
Now, my question is, can they collect unemployment?
Well,
for that time? That
I think they can, but unemployment, as you know, is only half of your salary if you can get it. And I'm not sure they can, but I think they can. But the problem is they used to have an agreement with Harvard to get alternative work over the summers. And I remember talking to people in that union who would they'd be working in the dining halls when the students are there, and then they'd be helping with painting or something else.
Or landscaping.
Over the summer. Yeah. And that worked out well. Harvard decided to get rid of that at some point. When they were, as they're still doing, outsourcing other work on campus, including my work is getting outsourced. So those are some of the main demands.
Having these people do the landscaping, let's give an example. In the summer, own people.
Bye-bye.
Oh, no, we got landscape company doing it, for pennies, whatever it is.
See you later. Yep. So, and also there is a union representing groundskeepers, and I haven't seen any of them at the picket line. I'm not blaming them. I'm just like, they're just sort of like not there. I used to know. I don't even know anymore what union they're in. Then there's like the people that drive the shuttles. I mean, there's like a lot of unions at Harvard. And one of the good things that has happened is the International Brother of Electrical Workers has refused to do some work at Harvard, because Harvard's always doing tons of renovation and building and stuff because they got so much money. They're refusing to work at one of the locations, which is really good. Also, the Teamsters, Local 25, has refused to deliver food. And they said they were going to do that before the strike.
And here's my anecdote.
Wait, before you tell your story, I just want to get to the facts. So hold on. Diego has a good story about running into this in his workplace. But anyway, what I'm leading up to here is that this strike is happening. It's the first strike in 30 years at Harvard. Over 700 workers. If they win, and what I'm afraid of is like not a real victory, said like it's a real victory, which is what my unionship specializes in. They call it repackaging or rebranding. They'll get a concessionary contract and try to make it seem like a victory. You know how many people between the scaring about strikes, no mobilization, no education, no protest, how many people voted against that really rotten contract that now, in my union, that now the hotel workers have to fight against, the healthcare concessions? Only about 53 or 58 people voted against it. Now, the turnout was low in the vote. It was like 1,000 something for it. But it should have been like 4,000 or 5,000 people voting, and there clearly weren't. But the bureaucracy bragged about that to the Harvard Crimson, the student newspaper. Yeah, we only had a few people vote against it. Isn't that, doesn't that show it was popular? Well, no, actually, I stand proudly as one of those people that voted against it. WMFO, you're on the air.
Hello, Jeff, it's Tom.
Tom Rad.
Hey,
don't get mad if you call in and you don't get through, because they just changed the phone system around, but I just was able to get it to work. So, hi.
Well,
welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to, very quickly, because I know you have a lot to talk about, and Diego has a lot to talk about, too, and I like to listen to you guys both. But I just wanted to say that on the matter of whether or not the dining workers can get unemployment in the summer.
Yes.
There's some kind of loophole whereby if they are, quote, dismissed, end quote, as opposed to, quote, laid off, that's illegal. That being dismissed means that you're just basically told to go home.
I'm not surprised.
And they can call you up and tell you to come back whenever.
Not surprised.
So because of that, the majority of the dining workers cannot collect unemployment.
Oh, it's evil. Yeah,
it's evil. And that's also in the winter term, day term. So I just wanted to bring that in. And
it's like a clause they have in unemployment. Let's say when I'm working, I only work there for 3 months, and then they say, we're going to shut down, I'm sorry, we're going to let you go. I can't collect because I have to complete 6 months to a year.
Okay.
In order to even qualify for unemployment.
Yeah, there's
so they'll cut you loose at 3 months, and they'll make sure these guys, the business people, they're not stupid. They know their loopholes, so they go, let's let him go now.
Yep.
Yeah. You know?
Well, I think
before he hits 6 months.
Hearing about a demand for an across the board minimum wage for their employees.
$35,000, a year.
Minimum wage.
Yep. Hey, but by the way, Tom.
Dining workers have this idea that it's part of a real community there, if what they call a sustainable community, where it's not just that they help sustain by feeding everybody three times a day, which they do, working super hard all the time, except when they're, quote, dismissed, but it's also that the employer has an obligation to them to help them sustain their lives. I went to this rally for them last spring at Adams' house on the campus, and it was heartbreaking hearing the stories, the testimony, the personal testimony by people who say if these healthcare increases go through, that they're ramming down our throats. We won't be able to take care of our elders, our sick in our family, our children. We won't be able to do anything that we could barely do now. That we have no choice. Our backs are against the wall. So I also think that it's really, really, if you'll give me a second, it's really ironic that Harvard is about to have, it might be this weekend, I'm not sure if it's this weekend or next weekend, over at Radcliffe, they're having this big symposium with all the mighty poobahs.
No, I didn't know about that.
Including the president of the university, Drew Faust, talking about the history of how Harvard was built, how that's intertwined with slavery. And it's not just Harvard, it's Yale and Brown and the others. And they're at the same time, they're turning, you know, they've created a pianist.
A plantation of modern days is slavery.
A modern day slavery, yeah. And oppression that is, you know, right in their own midst, in their backyard. And one final thing I'd like to say, and that is, I think you have to be careful when there's a strike on to build solidarity union to union. And I want to be aware of that, and I want to be sensitive to that, but I'm not that sensitive a guy to begin with, so I am going to level a criticism, another criticism against our union. And I saw the unelected director of our union standing kind of in the shadows, so to speak, at the rally, you know, just basically just sort of whispering to some other bureaucrat.
Not joining us on the picket line?
Not joining on the picket line, not holding a sign, not doing anything. In fact, looking like a police spy.
And that was a picket of like 400 people winding through Harvard Yard.
Yeah, and then the next day, I don't know if it's that day or the next day, we all get an email from the union, which basically says, in the mildest, blandest possible way, that our union supports the strike, without going into any actual tangible way that they're going to plan to do that, like setting up a financial fund to support these very low-paid workers who are
suffering. Or even a protest, nothing.
Or no protest, no organizing, no special membership meeting of our own 4,500 or however many we have to discuss what we should be doing.
We never have those.
No education.
No. Nothing like that. But yet, the next very next point is to point out in no uncertain terms that our union is not on strike. You are expected to go to report to work. I'm quoting. You are expected to report to work and work your regular hours. And I got to tell you, I don't need my union to be telling me to report to work like they were nothing more than a boss.
Yeah, an adjunct of human resources.
An adjunct of human resources. And, you know, I called them, the union, not that they, you know, they have somebody there to listen politely to people like me who want to call up to complain. And then the complaint goes in the wastebasket over there. But I said that to them. I said, that's just really like the opposite of what you want to hear from a union. And like the Teamsters, like you were saying, the Teamsters saying, we're not going to
deliver food. Ahead of time, ahead of the strike.
Yeah. Anyway, I just...
No, Tom, stay on for a second, okay? I want to give a context to what you're talking about and then make an announcement. It's only 1 second. All right, stay on. First of all, this is Tom calling in, and Tom is a worker at Harvard. And also, by the way, has been invited onto the show many times. The invitation still holds. I know it's a hassle to get here and everything, but anyway.
No, it's not bad, Jeff. So, it's not bad. It's that I spend most of my weekends at work.
Oh, there, that too. So anyway, but what I want to say, Tom, is I just want the listeners to know you're coming from a perspective of working at Harvard. I mean, maybe that was implicit in your... in your criticisms of the union leadership in our union. But also, Tom, this has gone out on Facebook, but it was just changed. The date has changed, so I want to get this out there really clearly. And this is what I was leading up to a minute ago. There's a Harvard Labor Solidarity Rally sponsored by the Massachusetts AFL-CIO this Thursday, October 13th at 2:30 p.m. in Harvard Square at the Cambridge Common, you know, the park there.
Yes.
And they say, this is from the AFL-CIO in Massachusetts, Harvard University, one of the wealthiest institutions in the world, is trying to shift healthcare costs out of the backs of hardworking dining service workers. Harvard refuses to offer affordable healthcare and sustainable incomes to the dining hall staff. Come out on October 13th to show your solidarity and send a message to Harvard that the Massachusetts Labor Movement stands with the Harvard workers. So this is huge.
It is huge.
It's an awkward time maybe for some workers, but I'm going to just take a very late lunch that day and
well,
go to that.
Time for the dining workers because it's around their change of shift.
Exactly. That's one reason. Yeah, exactly. That's why they're doing it. I'm glad you said that. So I just want to get that out there that originally it was a different day. Now it's Thursday, October 13th. Now, there's a chance the strike could end at any day because they're in mediation, but this is out there in case it hasn't ended by then, and people should plan on being there, in my opinion.
Is it still continuing at 3?
If it ends, maybe it will be.
Whenever there's any sign of movement, there's always this tendency to suspend whatever active oppositional rallying that goes on. I've noticed that. And
in this strike or in general?
Victory, they should have an enormous rally.
Yeah, I was just going to say that, too. It could be a victory rally. And, yes, it will go past 3, definitely. So Thursday, October 13th, 2:30 p.m.
All right.
Anything else, Tom? Thanks for calling.
No, I just wanted to say hi, and it's always good to listen to the program. And keep up the great work, the both of you.
Thanks for calling in, Tom. Take care.
Solidarity
forever.
Thank you.
Yep. Talk to you soon. Bye. And that's Tom Potter. Tom has called into the show, of course, before. At different times, we welcome his calls, and he's working at Harvard.
He's right about the irony about they talk about slavery, and here we are in a situation that's close to it.
Wage slavery, situation where if your choices are so limited without money.
I want to go there and go, shame, I'll probably get arrested, but.
Yeah, I guess a lot of people that have most people maybe under capitalism understand this, but just for those that maybe haven't had experienced that yet or they're young or something, since money rules, and if you don't have money, you don't have choices in this system. You know, they talk about capitalism being a system of choices. You don't have any choices, you don't have any money. If you don't have enough money, what this means for the dining hall workers, for example, is more money will go into healthcare, which is a necessity. They don't want to see their kids or whoever or their own selves die for lack of healthcare, right? So they'll do anything to pay that healthcare bill. And it comes out of your check anyway, right? But then you got less money for anything else. Think of it. Anything to do with leisure, anything to do with school. Like say you want schools charge now for
food.
For food. They charge for extracurricular activities. They charge for, of course, you know, why do the rich kids do better at standardized tests? Because they get tutoring. Tutoring is really expensive. You know, all your choices disappear. You know, I mean, my family's having such financial problems now. We're gauging up every time we take the car out. We're gonna be wasting, gas money, even as low, quote unquote, as gas is. You know, we're gonna be wasting gas money if we go somewhere. Do we go out or not? You know, and then you usually choose not to, and then that's something gone that you wanted to do. Like we wanted to go to Harvard yesterday because they had this free day at the Peabody Museum. That's where they have the dinosaur bones and stuff. Mm-hmm. Pretty cool place. And we get in for free because we work at Harvard, and they were gonna have cake, and they were gonna have extra music and stuff because we're celebrating 100th anniversary. And I was really getting into going to that. I was like, it's free, it's really cool. Then I thought, gee, okay, we're gonna take the car and spend money on gas because we live outside of Cambridge. It's gonna be a Saturday on a holiday weekend. It's gonna be kind of crowded. What about parking? We have to pay for parking. You know, have we eaten enough food so we don't have to buy food out? Turns out we hadn't. We were kind of dragging, a Saturday morning, kind of dragging our butts a little bit, you know. So all that just was like, no, we're not going to go. Fuck it. We're not going to go. And so that's like, you know, a good educational opportunity lost to my kids and maybe some fun. And, you know, that's it. We didn't go. So that's just one little choice. And then that's a leisure thing. It gets, of course, more important when you're talking about, do I keep the car running to pay the mortgage and all that? You know, that's another much more profound choice. But capitalism is all about choices, they say. I made the wrong choices, did the right choice. Individuals, all about the individual made the right choice. No. You have the money, you have the choices. You don't have the money, you don't have the choices. You have a little money, you have little choices. You have a lot of money, you have a lot of choices.
You got no money, you got no choices.
Yeah, that's capitalism. So anyway, we want to really stress that rally. Go out to that. But, you know, even before the rally, every weekday around noon, there's a picket at what they call Annenberg Hall, which is right next to the Science Center at Harvard. At the corner of Oxford and Kirkland Streets. You can go there. You'll see a lot of people there. You can go to the plaza in front of Harvard Square. It's actually Cambridge land, not Harvard land, but Harvard's kind of usurped it. But there's like this plaza in front of the Science Center at Harvard going over Cambridge Street in Cambridge. Go there around 5 p.m. in the evening. You might find some activity. Mostly it's that noon thing. And then there's a special rallies. And go to keep up with that, just look up Local 26. HERE Local 26. Actually, I haven't checked out if they have a website or not, but I'm assuming they do. I've got this Facebook announcement. Where do they say to go? Oh, this is another Mass AFL-CIO announcement. Yeah, okay. So anyway, also...
So the adult,
let's hear your story. You ran into the... you don't work at Harvard, you ran into the strike.
No. Right? I'm a fast food worker myself, so I'm in solidarity. Obviously, we're in the same industry. We're all working class, brothers and sisters. But this guy, that, you know, obviously he's in Cisco, which is the delivery. They're not union.
Food delivery company.
Yeah. Just like
I see their trucks. Yeah.
Unifier. And
they're like blue or something, right?
Yeah blue, silver. Gray. Yeah, they got the blue writing on it. But so this guy, and they're based out of Houston. So obviously they're southern, you know. Southern state, you know, obviously anti-union.
Probably.
And they're not union. He's not union.
Yeah.
He gets to my location, which is on Cambridge Street, right down the street from Harvard.
In Cambridge,
which is the same street. And he has to deliver to Harvard. He goes to me first. And I go, great, I'm doing the fryers. I'm getting the old grease out to put in a new one. And I'm like, great, now I have to stop here because I got to get all these perishables in the walk-in and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, why so early? He goes, well, I don't want to cross that picket line, and you know, and it's early. I want to get us in and out from Harvard because of the strike.
Uh-huh.
And I'm like, aren't you union? No. He's like, no, we're not union.
Yeah, why not, dude?
No, but it's like, I just want to make a living. I'm just gotta, you know, I got mouths to feed. You know,
no one else does, buddy.
Yeah, nobody else does.
You feed the mouths better if you're in the union, by the way. So what did the guy say after that? He was on his way to Harvard, basically.
Yeah, now I gotta go and cross his picket line, something like that. It's like, then don't cross it. I was saying to myself.
Yeah.
But
so we're supposed to on the air here look at advertisements for a fundraising drive. Is that still going on? I can't remember.
PSA?
Yeah, fundraising drive here at WMFO. I'm not sure it's still happening, though. Anyway, go to WMFO.org and check out if our fundraising drive is still going on. And I realize I should know that, but I'm lacking the information on the board here that I had last time I was in.
It says right there.
For how long?
It says, hey, free form.
Yeah, but for how long? This doesn't say. I think that might be an old sign. But anyway, use the PSA button. All right. There we go. Thank you, Diego. Select S. Yeah, there we go. Yay. Thank you, Diego. So we're going to take a quick break here, and you're going to hear about donating to WMFO. And maybe we'll put a song on, and we'll be back with more of Socialist Alternative Radio. We're talking about Indigenous Peoples Day and some other related matters, and we'll get to the elections. So you're listening to Socialist Alternative Radio on WMFO 91.5 FM, Tufts Free Form, commercial-free, community-based radio.
So we like to ask the important questions, such as, why Freeform? Well, it's been our tradition now for 45 years, and none of us here want to see that change anytime soon. Do you? If not, we need your help to keep WMFO Freeform by contributing to our annual donations drive. Anytime before April 13th, go over to donate.wmfo.org to support us in reaching our $5,000 goal. You will even receive a unique thank you gift. To see more about what our DJs have to say about keeping WMFO Freeform, visit facebook.com/WMFO Medford. That's facebook.com/WMFO Medford.
The WMFO annual drive is in effect. We're looking to raise $5,000 to continue to keep your Freeform station playing your favorite music. WMFO is a nonprofit station with staff, students, and community members who volunteer their time to bring you their favorite music and shows. We need your support to keep it all running, so donate now by logging on to donate.wmfo.org. That's donate.wmfo.org. Or mail a check payable to trustees of Tufts College. Send it to WMFO, P.O. Box 65, Medford, Massachusetts, 02155. Thank you for your support from all of us here at your Freeform station, 91.5 WMFO.
And it's pulling in today. We won't be coming home tonight, love. The fight has just begun. Raise your voices all together, motherfucker.
Worldwide Rebel Songs by Tom Morello from his album The Night Watchman.
Yeah.
I think that came out last year, if I'm not mistaken. Maybe this year, earlier.
What, Tom Morello?
Yeah.
I think it came out during Occupy.
Oh, yeah, maybe further back than that. Yeah.
2011.
Yeah, let's see. Where's the... I have the...
Because I remember when they came, when we were doing, they were doing Occupy, that came out.
2011. You win the prize today. All right, so you're back with Social
Alternative Radio. I want extra sugar
in
my coffee.
Yeah. Co-hosts Diego and Jeff, and we are here every other Sunday with Social Alternative Radio. One or both of us. Others, many. We are many. They are few. And we're going to talk about Indigenous Peoples Day now. That is the new name for a new holiday based on the ashes of the old Columbus Day. Now, why Indigenous Peoples Day? And then you had a good anecdote about that. You said you were at a meal at a church or something, and
oh,
there were a bunch
yeah,
of like,
yesterday,
white workers going on about it or something
yeah,
like that.
Yeah, it's like, yeah. You know, I was telling him about the library system says, oh, in observance of the indigenous people there instead of Columbus. It's like, what is indigenous? What is that whole, whoa, what do they care? Or something like that, you know?
Yeah. Indigenous means they were here first.
Indigenous also here, means like an indigenous animal or something of that habitat. You know, like you were born in this country, you're indigenous, you know what I mean?
Yeah, think about sort of, yeah. Well, if you go back far enough, there's no such thing as indigenous because of evolution. Yeah. But at a certain point, people came to North America and a long, long time ago.
I was explaining to him the reason why they call us Indians, because Columbus was trying to look for a new route to India.